Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
How well did you sleep tonight and what was the quality of your rest? Well, actually, quality sleep is crucial for our health and emotional well-being, offering numerous benefits such as improved overall health, better weight management, reduced stress, but also enhanced cardiac health and metabolism. And with that said, I warmly welcome you to a new episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. I'm Thomas, your host, and I look forward to another really thought-provoking discussion with a very senior expert in the health technology space. After exploring the impact of behavioral science on health in our last episode, we will today feature another really captivating topic, which is sleep and breathing health. We will actually examine how transformative digital health technologies can support people in the diagnosis, treatment, but also the wider support for sleep apnea. That said, I'm really thrilled to have a distinguished expert with us to explore this subject in way more depth. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Dr. Carlos Nunes. Carlos serves as the Chief Medical Officer at ResMed, which is an innovative and leading health technology company focused on sleep, breathing, and care delivered in the home. In his role, he oversees medical affairs, healthcare economics, and government relations with more than two decades of leadership experience. In addition to ResMed, his professional development has been dedicated to aligning clinical realities with strategic business initiatives in global medical tech firms like Becton Dickinson, CareFusion, and also Pisces. Prior to his career in the medtech industry, Carlos was a practicing anesthesiologist, intensivist, as well as hospitalist. And since 2025, Carlos is a member of the executive board for the Consumer Technology Association, which is North America's largest technology trade association and also the organizer of the famous yearly CES fair in Las Vegas. Carlos actually holds an MD from the University of Miami School of Medicine, completing his postgraduate training in anesthesiology, critical care medicine, and clinical research. So as you can see from this introduction, Carlos is really a very distinguished expert with proven experience in medical, scientific, public policy, but also business leadership. So that said, Carlos, I'm really grateful to have you on the podcast episode today.
Thank you, Thomas. It's my pleasure to be here.
You are obviously an expert in sleep health. How well did you actually sleep? And what are the strategies to maintain a high quality of sleep yourself?
You know, it's an excellent question. It's the question that I love to ask people myself. I usually sleep okay. Believe it or not, you would think that someone with my background, and thank you for the lovely introduction, would sleep great. But everybody has a bad night of sleep here and there, and actually had a poor night of sleep last night. Not poor, but not great. But like everybody, there are very simple things that you can do to help you get that good, healthy sleep that you require. And before I give you the key to long life and longevity and health, I just want to mention that the reason why sleep is so important is when you think of the three pillars of human health, which are sleep, the food that we eat, you know, our nutrition, and the way we move our bodies, you know, exercise and physical activity. Sleep is absolutely the most important. But we have focused for so long, for decades as a society, on things like diet and exercise and the fads that go along with them. And it's really only lately that we focus on sleep. And there are very simple things that we can do to have good, healthy sleep, because as we've seen, when we ask people about their sleep, everyone says they are struggling, whether it's simple, you know, insomnia that happens once in a while, to actual sleep disorders. And so for me, the things you can do that everyone can do: a regular schedule, find a good time to go to sleep every night, and the same time more or less to wake up every morning. The more regular that schedule is, the better it is for your health. Hopefully that schedule lasts for 7-8 hours of good, healthy sleep in a room that's quiet, that's dark, that's cool, that's comfortable, free from distractions. If everyone could start there, we would probably help a lot of people get over that first part of poor sleep. And that's just what we call sleep hygiene, those things I described. But yes, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about it. And it's super, super important.
Hey, but passion is probably a good keyword, because you, to me, uniquely combine medical expertise with a true passion for technology. And when we came here, you also kind of described yourself as kind of a nerd when it comes to technology. How do you integrate that with medical practice today?
You know, it's interesting. It's sort of the key driver of my entire career. When I was practicing medicine, as you mentioned, I worked in the operating room as an anesthesiologist and in the ICU as an intensivist, around the areas where patients are the most ill and the devices are the most technologically advanced, like ventilators and anesthesia machines and infusion pumps. When I transitioned into industry, it was that love of technology that made me realize we could apply things like information technology and data analysis, now the things that we think about when we think of the proliferation of AI, into solutions that can not just take care of one patient at a time, but can help millions or billions of people at a time. And so when you think of sleep, you think about the fact that all 8 billion of us spend a third of our lives sleeping, or at least we should. And then when you think about big sleep disorders like sleep apnea, for example, that a billion people have, and there's, you know, hundreds of millions of people that don't breathe while they sleep every single night, using technology is the only way that you're going to scale to be able to reach everybody and to provide them the therapy they deserve in a way that's connected, that's efficient and effective.
That is, I mean, to be honest, really great that you have that experience also in direct patient care as a practicing anesthesiologist and intensivist earlier in your career, but also combining this now with your current perspectives and priorities in the work that you're doing in digital health and medical technology. How do you still go back and leverage that experience from back in the days when being a practitioner directly intersecting with patients? And how does that influence your contribution in the medtech world?
It's very, very important to ensure that everything we do, even on the commercial side, you know, working in the industry, working for a company like ResMed, is focused on the patient, is patient-centric. You know, as you mentioned in the introduction, ResMed is a company that is focused on sleep health, breathing health, and health tech in the home. And when we talk about our aspirations and our goals, you know, we talk about our product org and we talk about, you know, the value we bring, but we always say that it is patient-centric and the patient really is the focus of everything we do. And then you, if you imagine the patient in the center, it's almost like layers of an onion going out. Then there's the provider, and then there's the system within which the provider gives care to that patient. Then there's, you know, the country or a large national system within which they work. And then there are global and regional things to consider. And industry has to span all of that. So if you keep the patient at the center, that's a really good start. But then you have to also understand that the patient behaves a certain way when they're in a doctor's office or when they're in the hospital. But that's the minority of their lives. They mostly live their lives where they live, where they sleep, where they eat, where they work, where they spend time with their friends and loved ones. And so in the medtech industry, as we get closer to this promised future of digital health and AI-driven digital health, you have to get close to the patient, not just in the clinic or in the hospital, but in their lives. You have to talk to them where they are and make sure the messages that they need to hear, what questions should I ask my doctor? What therapies may be right for me? They're getting them from trusted sources, but the sources where they happen to be. And it's not always in a medical journal. It's not always at a medical conference. It may be meeting them where they are in social media or the conversations they're having with their friends.
No, 100%. And I'm truly also convinced that healthcare, not the sick care, but healthcare really needs to be happening in the 24/7, day by day, and not the, I don't know, 24 hours that we have as an individual at a doctor's place annually, right? So that's not where health can be actually happening. This is the only way you can get some help and advice, but health needs to be at home, at work, at leisure, wherever it happens. So I'm 100% with you there. But probably before we jump into this, let's explore sleep apnea for a bit, which is a condition you are personally well-versed in, and that nearly 1 billion people worldwide suffer from. I was really astonished to see this. So for our listeners, could you probably briefly explain what sleep apnea is and describe some common symptoms that patients might experience? So probably for us to all carefully listen whether we have some of those symptoms ourselves. Huh?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you brought up the eye-opening statistic. Yes, sleep apnea is a condition that affects nearly 1 billion people. And that billion number is from about 6 years ago now. So it's probably 1 billion or more. So think of it. It's 1 out of every 8 people. And what it means is that when you sleep, your airway collapses. When your muscles relax and you get into that relaxed state, for whatever reason, your anatomy is such that your throat collapses and you stop breathing. Apnea, Latin for lack of breath, no breath. And sleep obviously means it's happening while you sleep, which makes this a particular interesting condition because you don't know it's happening. But the sequence of events is the airway collapses, you stop breathing, you are actually suffocating. Your blood oxygen level drops. Your brain starts to notice that something is wrong. It's like, oh, we are suffocating. We're not getting oxygen. And so it sends an adrenaline rush through your body, enough to make your heart start racing, enough to make your blood pressure shoot up, enough to make you gasp for air and take a breath, but usually not enough to wake you up. So you never know it happens. And it happens over and over all night long. And it's often recognized by people that have common symptoms like snoring, or sometimes it even, you know, their bed partner can say it sounds like they stop breathing or gasp for air. But some people don't have those classic symptoms. In many women, sleep apnea is misdiagnosed as insomnia because they may not snore or snore loudly, and they may describe other symptoms like feeling tired, having headaches in the morning. Those are also classic symptoms of sleep apnea. So my advice to people, I always try to keep things simple. I mentioned sleep hygiene. If you have questions about your sleep, first start with that sleep hygiene. If you can't get your sleep to where you think it's good by making those simple steps, then ask your doctor about your sleep. You may not have sleep apnea, but there are other sleeping disorders. Insomnia is a real clinical disorder that affects hundreds of millions of people. But back to sleep apnea. Yeah, it's an incredibly prevalent condition, 1 out of every 8 people. And you have to think of it that way. Think of it like astigmatism or flat feet. You know, there are a certain percentage of people in the population that are born with anatomy that's different. The shape of their eye or the shape of their foot arch is different. And in some people, the anatomy of their throat and their upper airway is such that when they relax, when they sleep, the airway collapses and they can actually suffocate. Someone with mild sleep apnea may stop breathing 5 or 10 times an hour, every hour while you're asleep. Moderate sleep apnea could be 20-something, 30-something. And I've seen people with severe sleep apnea stop breathing 50, 60 times an hour, once a minute, suffocate. So that's what it is, and that's why it's so important.
Thanks for sharing that and making it so kind of feelable or touchable even. And you also raised a couple of symptoms or shared those like tiredness, bad sleep. They are, I mean, not very kind of decisive to say this must be a sleep apnea. That's also probably the reason why many of those sleep apnea are undiagnosed, despite they have a significant impact on the quality of life and overall health of individuals, as you were kindly sharing. At ResMed, you do focus on improving sleep and breathing health, as we said before. Can you probably share how you detect and treat those conditions at the earliest stage possible? And how do you leverage innovative technology to do so?
Yeah, so the key is, going back to sleep apnea, it is the most prevalent condition that at ResMed our therapies are focused on. Like you said, the majority of those billion people are undiagnosed and untreated. It's about 800 to 850 million people. It's an incredible number. Yeah. And so really the first focus is awareness. Those 800 million people, they're not reading the scientific journals where, you know, we publish our research. It's important and we will always do it because that's how you drive forward innovation. But those people, They talk to their friends. They talk to their primary care physician, who is may not be a sleep specialist. They get their information on social media even. And so first and foremost, we need to reach them by raising the awareness. Once we raise the awareness of the importance of sleep and that there are conditions like sleep apnea that have effective therapy, we have to make sure people know what questions to ask. It's part of the awareness, and that those primary care physicians know how to respond to those questions. The average physician in medical school gets very little training about sleep. And only if you go to specialize into sleep medicine do you really understand all of the different conditions from sleep apnea to insomnia to restless leg syndrome to narcolepsy to everything that can impact human sleep. And then it's increasing the access to testing. There's something really interesting happening. In the last year, some of the major wearables manufacturers in the consumer tech space, so Apple, Samsung, et cetera, have released devices with FDA clearance to detect sleep apnea. So we're going to start to see more and more patients showing up at their doctor saying, "Hey, doc, my watch said that I have sleep apnea. What do I do?" And if that primary care physician isn't equipped to answer the question or to refer that patient to get a proper sleep test and to get into the therapy that they need and they deserve, then that patient could be lost. And so we need to also strengthen that pathway, build those digital solutions so patients can get screened. Lots of it can be done online or touchless so that clinicians work flow is streamlined. And so it improves the efficiency and the efficacy of therapy. And then you think about expanding that across all of sleep health. What do those solutions look like for insomnia or restless leg syndrome? For breathing health, people that live at home with conditions like COPD or neuromuscular disease who may be on ventilators, what do those modern solutions look like? How do those devices get connected to the cloud and the data gets used to improve the user experience? So it's an entire digital ecosystem building out around sleep health and breathing health. But then the last piece is that health tech in the home. There is an interesting area between consumer technology, which I touched on with the wearables, but then medical technology, traditional med tech, moving closer to the consumer. And so we are starting to see more solutions that happen in the home. And, you know, sleep apnea is a great example. A CPAP device sits on your bedstand. It's a very personal, intimate medical solution in your home that's now very technological and usually cloud connected. How does that extend? Because I believe the connected home of the future is the healthy home of the future. And we're going to see more and more health delivered at home through consumer and proper medical devices.
To that last point, I'm also very much convinced that the future home needs to be a healthy home and have connected devices intrinsically available and contribute to overall status of people's health. So what I'm getting from what you just explained, it's the awareness of people, it's the education also of professionals, it's the availability of testing like the Oura Rings, the Apple Watches, you named a few, but also then the health tech at home to really improve patients' lives through this. So moving from there, we discussed that obviously apnea is also contributing to health problems such as hypertension, chronic fatigue, but also diabetes and obesity. And with the rise of GLP-1 therapeutics like Ozempic and Mounjaro, they contribute to obesity management beyond the original realm of diabetes care. In a recent study that we at Strategy End did, we asked also medtech industry players about the projected impact these GLP-1 medicines have on their business model, based on the hypothesis, obviously, that lesser people being obese will lead to a decreasing demand for insulin pumps, artificial knees, or in the case of ResMed, sleep apnea devices. However, what we found is, surprisingly, the majority of responding companies foresee an uplift even of their business from the GLP-1 boom. So, first of all, what is your perspective on this? And secondly, what other major trends do you observe in the medtech industry by and large currently, as well in the near future?
An excellent point around comorbidities and the effect of GLP-1s. Let me start with the comorbidities, and then we'll go through GLP-1s, and then we'll go into, you know, sort of the future of medtech. So, you know, we talked a lot about what sleep apnea is, but you mentioned, what does it do? You know, aside from interfering with your sleep that night, every night, which gives you short-term effects. For example, you know, waking up tired, excessive daytime somnolence, poor sleep, whether from sleep apnea or other means, other reasons, increases the likelihood of things like road traffic accidents, workplace accidents. But long-term sleep apnea also affects, like you mentioned, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, metabolic conditions like obesity, type 2 diabetes. There's also a very interesting and growing body of evidence that supports poor sleep, and also the poor sleep from sleep apnea is a major risk factor for dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So that one, that should be pretty scary for everybody about sleep and sleep health. And you're right, GLP-1s are, you know, an amazing advancement, although the first GLP-1s were approved by the FDA 20 years ago. It's really this latest generation, or the generation that's just now sort of becoming the last generation of GLP-1s that have gotten all the attention, because the weight loss effects are much more significant than some of the earlier ones. And they are really, really effective at managing type 2 diabetes, at managing obesity, at managing other comorbidities, even have a role to play in obstructive sleep apnea. Patients with obesity do have higher rates of sleep apnea. We do see, not a majority, but there is a percentage of people that with sleep apnea that do have obesity. But sleep apnea also happens in babies. It happens in people who have a BMI that is in the normal or not in the obese range. And we know that BMI is not perfect. But I think overall, GLP-1s are important and are good. And when you look at some of the studies, there was a study done by Eli Lilly, or sponsored by Eli Lilly, that looked at the treatment of OSA by GLP-1s. The group that did the best was the one treated with GLP-1s and CPAP at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it stands to reason. Weight management has always been a part of therapy for OSA. You know, it's always, and it's 100% always starts with the anatomy, but your weight can affect your anatomy, obviously. And so, you know, healthy weight and exercise has always been a part of managing OSA, of managing obstructive sleep apnea. And so what we've felt is, you know, at least in the early days of this recent kind of hype cycle we're in around GLP-1s, that it would be a tailwind for us, because it would answer that question I mentioned just a few moments ago about awareness. It would tell more people that, you know, managing your weight is important, and it may have an effect on obstructive sleep apnea. And you see Eli Lilly actually doing a pretty extensive educational campaign on obstructive sleep apnea. It's called Don't Sleep on OSA, which has been great, because that is a tailwind for us. And the more people who go to the doctor and ask about sleep apnea and want to manage their weight, the more likely they are to get screened, to get diagnosed. And if they are appropriate for CPAP therapy, then they'll go on CPAP therapy. And we do a lot of modeling. My team is involved with some of the other commercial teams to do epidemiologic modeling and even some commercial modeling. And what we've found, and we report this, you'll hear us talk about this, you know, when we do our earnings calls and when we have calls with investors and analysts. So we talk about this publicly, but when we look at, you know, millions of patients of data, someone who has a GLP-1 prescription and is diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea is more likely to start CPAP therapy. And if you look at them, you know, a couple of years out, as they stay on CPAP therapy, they are more likely to order more disposable supplies in the future, a new mask or a new tube or a new cushion. So what we are finding is these patients are more engaged with their health. They're showing up in the healthcare system where they may never have shown up before. They are net new patients for us, and they stay our patients longer. So it's really good to see that the modeling we did, thinking this would be a tailwind, was a tailwind. Now, when we think about the future, I think GLP-1s are always going to be a part of that future because, as I said, weight management has always been a part of managing obstructive sleep apnea. So that is a part of our future, is how do we continue to coexist as pharma, you know, focuses more and more on obesity and comorbidities. But then the tech future around sleep health and breathing health continues to evolve, I think, as we talked about before, closer to that consumer space. Because one, it's closer to the patient and where they happen to be. But two, it's where the pace of innovation is growing so quickly, especially around AI and the use of information and data, which, as we know, there's not an app, there's not a device, there's not a platform where the data is not being collected in ways, you know, in healthcare, usually it's ways that are private and secure and all, you know, above board, but they're being used to improve the patient experience, and AI is a part of that. Sorry, it was a lot of questions and a lot of answers all rolled into one.
But you did greatly. I just want to echo that I also think that GLP-1s are great solutions against obesity conditions, but also lift the awareness of people that obesity is also to be seen and managed also as a disease. But it's not the golden bullet in itself. It needs a change in life that comes along with different food, exercise, and sleep patterns that need to be triggered next to the GLP-1 intake. So it cannot be the only solution to everything, I assume. So, but that said, another important trend that does affect the MedTech business model is prevention in itself. And prevention is something that we also believe very much in. And while we talk about patient up until here, prevention, in my perspective, also needs to be much more people-driven, not only patient-driven. And what we call the emergence of a life care ecosystem, which is less focused on disease care, but rather well care, merits that we see the patient more as a human. And in this context, digital technology helps people also living hopefully healthier lives and preventing illnesses, especially through the availability of wearables to track, but also optimize one's own state of health. From your perspective, how is patient, but also people engagement evolving in the context of preventative digital health solutions? Because as a patient, obviously, you have a problem, you go to see a doctor because something hurts, something is not right. But if we talk prevention, we merely have a problem. So we're consumers, we're just humans. And how do you see this, particularly in managing conditions like sleep apnea through AI-driven sleep trackers or other tools?
It's a really excellent area to discuss because I am a huge believer in what you started with. We like to call our systems healthcare systems, but most of them are set up and even incentivized to, as you said, provide sick care. They are disease intervention systems. They're much better at that than they are at prevention or primary care. So I couldn't agree more. And as I said at the beginning, you know, I truly believe sleep is one of the three pillars of human health and the most important of the three. And so preventive care and good health care begins every single day in your home by finding out how to get that most optimal night of sleep, right? That's yep. Where it all starts for prevention. And then as you mentioned before, when we were talking of GLP-1s, there is the nutrition, there is the exercise or physical activity that plays a part. And, you know, one of the things that I mentioned earlier was if we think of sleep apnea, again, it starts with the anatomy of your airway. You're born with anatomy this way. Like I said, babies can have it, children can have it, people with all different sizes and shapes of heads and mouths and, you know, throat anatomy, for whatever reason, people of all shapes and sizes can have sleep apnea, just like you can have flat feet, for example, as I said, or astigmatism, right? So there's a part of healthcare where it's not that you are dealing with a disease. Sleep apnea, interestingly enough, is not a disease. It's a condition. It's something that is much more multifactorial. A disease has like a specific cause. Like, you know, if you get bacterial pneumonia, is because this bacteria caused your pneumonia, that's a disease state, versus a condition, which can be a variety of factors. And when you think about it, sleep apnea, the most effective gold standard therapy, CPAP, is just helping take the air in your bedroom and get that air into your lungs, past yep. an obstruction in your throat. There's nothing more natural than that, right? There's nothing more preventative for suffocation than air. And so when you think about a modern CPAP device is air, and if you live in a dry climate or if you prefer humidification, it might also be air plus water. That's it. There's no surgery, there's no implants, there's no injections, there's no drugs. So when you think about prevention, if you want to prevent all of those risks we talked about, you know, an increased risk of hypertension, other cardiovascular disease, arrhythmias, stroke, we talked about dementia in men, erectile dysfunction. You want to talk about preventive care, breathing while you sleep. There's nothing more natural than sleeping and breathing. And a device that can help get that air from your room into your lungs is an amazing preventive care measure, especially because it's all natural. Like I said, just air and water. You also mentioned patient engagement around prevention. Like I said before, and I know I get it, I'm very passionate about this one topic, but if there's 1 billion people that are struggling with this disorder, and most of them, 800 plus million, don't even know they have it or aren't on therapy, there is an awareness problem. The tech is amazing. The devices are small and comfortable and quiet, and the masks are incredible. I have sleep apnea. I won't sleep one night without my CPAP. I wear that mask joyfully. And guess what? It's the only therapy that cures two people at the same time because my wife has never slept better now that I no longer snore and gasp for air and keep her awake. So, you know, engaging patients, getting people past the misinformation and understanding that there are therapies out there. There's a reason why you should be sleeping well, as well as watching your diet and your exercise. They're the most important things you can do for your health.
And while we are talking, actually, I'm checking out my profile. So for now, I have a rating of good for my breathing. Yeah? So I only have rarely apnea moments, but last night I had 5, actually. You tell me whether this is good or bad, but it says at least the app says I'm good. Yeah? Can I trust this?
Yes. No. So believe it or not, it is normal for a person to occasionally have an apnea while you sleep, and up to 5 an hour or less than 5 an hour is still considered normal. It's when you get to 5 or more that it is considered clinical sleep apnea. So if you are only having a few per night, that is what would be considered normal, you know, sort of the clinical normal variant of how we all sleep.
That brings me also probably into another field, because I recently had the pleasure of speaking to Professor Jochen Werner, who is a leading German medical expert running a big clinic in Germany, thousands of patients and beds to occupy, who emphasized that AI is set to really end-to-end revolutionize every aspect of healthcare. So considering the rapid advancements and the increasing integration of cutting-edge technologies at a doctor's place in a hospital, but also at home, like the Whoop wristband and the Apples and the Auras within the healthcare sector, how do you foresee digital health tools, AI, but also telemedicine, has the potential of transforming the identification, the diagnosis, but also the treatment of chronic and oftentimes underdiagnosed conditions like sleep apnea? How do you see that potential in the few years to come?
I think the potential is huge. I am a huge believer in the power of data and information technology. And what we've seen with the proliferation, primarily of large language models after the unleashing of ChatGPT on the public, has been that information technology went over a tipping point where the cost and power of compute and memory and the size of training data, basically the entire internet, made it so that these chatbots and this generative AI became useful. And it's becoming useful everywhere, including healthcare. When I think of healthcare and AI, I think of it in 3 different domains. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, healthcare is a huge industry. In the United States, for example, it's roughly 18-19% of our gross domestic product. It is the largest industry in the US, and as we know, it's the most expensive healthcare system per capita on the planet. It's an industry that employs a lot of people across many different employers in many different sectors. And like every field, all of those people, including the doctors and nurses and other clinicians at the front lines talking to patients, are dealing with the way that AI is disrupting the workplace. So all of the productivity around things like Copilot or the way you're doing emails and summarizing, all the things that everybody, whether you work as an actuary at an insurance company or you work as a nurse for a healthcare system, AI is affecting the way you work as an employee in the workplace, number one. Number two, your work happens to be customer facing, where the customers, I'm talking about clinicians, the customers are patients. And so there is that AI that has to interface with customers in a way that is trusted, in a way that is verifiable, and in a way that is mostly true because we're talking about healthcare, where humans will not tolerate a level of error from some machine making decisions about their loved one's cancer, for example. And then the third domain where healthcare has to worry about AI is that every patient is exposed to AI across all of their different domains and is going to show up in the doctor's office with their 3 or 4 pages that they printed out from Dr. GPT, who said, "Hey, doc, I did the deep dive research on X, Y, or Z, and here's all the information. Tell me what I need to do next. So we have to consider AI disrupting healthcare from all three of those different domains. And then you're right. The key that we have here is how do we access the data that drives the efficiency and the productivity gains so we can apply AI across those domains, especially the first two, where we'll be actually controlling the application of AI in the workplace and clinically externally facing AI, by the platforms where we collect the data, by the platforms where we understand the context and the environment, so we can build these AI models that will help make care more efficient. And then the last thing I'll say is that ResMed is actually in an interesting position here. Our first cloud-connected devices hit the market, you know, more than a decade ago.
Is it a decade ago already? Okay.
Yeah. So we have tens of millions of cloud-connectable devices in patients' homes. And we have tens of billions of days and nights of sleep and respiratory data that, with permission, patients either have to opt in or opt out of the data appropriately based on which country and which region and the privacy. But all the data is kept private, de-identified, and it's used to do research. It's used to improve the products. It's not like sold. We're not using it to, you know, publish banner advertising on a website. We're using the data to make products better and improve patients' lives with their permission. And you said the word telemedicine. Having those connected devices in patients' homes allows that data to travel. It's cloud connected at all times. You know, these devices, you turn them on, they have a cellular radio. So there's no Bluetooth or Wi-Fi to pair. The data is just there. And the doctor can see the data from a distance. And that connectivity, that connected care, a decade ago, we proved that digital health, that telemedicine works. And I'll tell you why. If I hand you a CPAP machine, just a run-of-the-mill CPAP machine, because you were diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, there's a 50-50 chance that you're going to use it. If that device is connected to the cloud so that your doctor can see the data and see how you're doing, the chance that you're going to be adherent to therapy increases above 70%. That's greater than adherence to medication, which hovers around 55% or so. But more importantly, if I enable the patient themselves directly, if I give them an app so that they can see their own data, and this is a published study that ResMed sponsored, the patient has access to the data. Their adherence to therapy now jumps to above 85%. So we proved more than a decade ago that if you connect the device so that you can use the data to generate insights and put it in front of the right people in the right context, you now get greater adherence to therapy that is going to help save lives in the future because you're decreasing the risk for all of those comorbidities. The last thing I'll mention is just as important as the research we do around tech and connectivity and digital health, as well as the actual disease states and the therapies. You mentioned health economics. Health economics is really important because this data-driven ecosystem can also help us do big data, real-world evidence, health economics research. And so we've been able to put all the pieces together. So you build a tech-driven device that's connected to the cloud. You allow the right people to see that data. You improve adherence to therapy, and then you decrease utilization in the healthcare system. So we've been able to show that patients with sleep apnea and certain comorbidities, like congestive heart failure, for example, when they're adherent to therapy, they show up in the emergency room less. They're admitted to the hospital less. They cost the healthcare system thousands of dollars per year less. So that's the goal. It's using technology, not just to build a cool connected device, but it's to pull it all the way through to the ultimate outcome that helps patients get their best outcomes and helps the healthcare system with their best economic and efficiency outcome.
And I really find this very fascinating. And I do believe there is, through a dramatic rise in wearable technologies, individuals do obviously have access to unprecedented amounts of data, health data, and there is great potential in technology and the resulting data. In a previous episode with two Swiss behavioral science professors, Urte Schulz and Claudia Witt, we did actually discuss the dilemma of relying heavily on data that may not always be kind of evidence-based, potentially also overshadowing personal perception and intuition of somebody's health. I'm really intrigued to ask you from your perspective, how can individuals basically strike the right balance between leveraging this influx of in many, many cases, very helpful data, insightful data, while also trusting their own feelings and instincts regarding their well-being, especially in the context of sleep health, because people sometimes might also be overreacting to results coming from any device, from Dr. GPT, as you rightly put it before. How do you see this, striking that right balance?
It's an excellent point, striking the balance, because I'll give you a quick anecdote. As we discussed before we started offline, I am a nerd, and I actually was learning to train an AI model on how to recognize people, and you set a threshold for how well it recognized somebody. It's the same with all of the data that we are bombarded with, right? I used the word insights before. You have to take data and convert it into insights. And those insights have to wrap in a little bit of those feelings and instincts as best you can when you're training these models, because healthcare is a science, but it is also an art. And everybody is different. Everybody responds to therapy and medications differently. And so it can't just be overwhelming pure data. It has to really be insights based on experience, based on context that respects and understands biases in training data, so that together with AI, a clinician can come to the right decisions, can potentially be helped and guided in asking the right questions, et cetera. Because, as you mentioned, focusing too much on the raw data can sometimes be counterproductive. In the context of sleep, there is a condition called orthosomnia, where people who start wearing like a Fitbit or an Oura ring and start tracking their sleep become so fixated on the numbers that they ruin their sleep. They can't sleep. They actually start getting worse insomnia because they're trying to improve their sleep with a tracker. I actually know somebody who suffered orthosomnia and had to basically take a break from all of their health tracking devices because they ruined their sleep by trying to improve it. Too much data.
But that is really kind of the call to action and caution to strike that right balance. I mean, big thanks for sharing that. I mean, having you as a true expert at that intersect of medicine, practitioner yourself in the health tech space for many, many years, solutions on the market. Fast forward 5 years from now, if we were to meet again for, I don't know, episode 225, what are the big advancements that we might have seen and would be discussing then in 5 years from now when it comes to sleep apnea, but also beyond? What are the big changes we as humankind would have achieved in healthcare by then?
I think it's going to be on a couple of fronts. One, around awareness and trust. We have to do a lot of work with people. I say people because they may be, you know, consumers of information, and before they become a patient of any condition or on any therapy. And so we have to continue to build awareness and trust around just the greater trend of technology infusing healthcare, including AI infusing healthcare, and getting closer to the home, you know, living on your phone and in your wearables much more so than now. So again, getting society ready. The other thing is the proliferation of sensors and wearables and nearables, and the smart home is going to give us ever more data around people all the time, where they live. It's going to be physiologic. It's going to be clinical grade. You know, we've already got wearables, as I said, FDA cleared for sleep apnea detection. It's only going to proliferate. And so I think we're going to see more and more of that healthcare, preventive health, you know, general health and wellness, and even the basics of healthcare and managing your basic healthcare needs shifted largely to the home because technology will enable that. It's going to be that in the not too distant future, you can step in front of your mirror while you stand on your bathroom scale, and it's going to run a basic assessment on your breathing, maybe even your oxygen saturation. And we're going to get there. There's nothing stopping us technologically. It's really the priorities and adoption and who will pay for all of this. But we have the ability technologically to get that smart home of the future, healthy home of the future, engaged patient, connected telemedicine future that we strive for. It's the only way that with finite resources, we can continue to take care of a growing and aging world that will continue to have more and more chronic conditions. You know, even with GLP-1 adoption, you look at the modeling out to 2050, obesity in the United States continues to grow, even with GLP-1 adoption. Sleep apnea rates in the U.S. continue to grow through 2050, even with the adoption of GLP-1s. And so we're going to need to adopt technological solutions at scale, closer to the patient, so that we can ensure that the precious few healthcare dollars are going to help us live these longer, healthier lives. You hear people talk a lot about health span, not just lifespan, those healthy years at the end. That's what we want to strive for, and that's where technology at scale can help.
So what a great outlook, I have to admit. And I really look personally also forward to really help realize this future of health. And to be honest, that makes me also get up in the morning after hopefully a good sleep. And with that said, this is a wrap. Today we have covered yet a new era of healthcare, namely sleep health and how technology can help to improve it. Really, really big thanks to you, Carlos, for sharing your really profound expertise and experiences, enriching also our discussion on this vital topic with very concrete examples. So big thanks for taking the time with us today.
It was my pleasure. It was a great discussion and just a lovely conversation.
Hey, thank you very much. And also to our listeners, thank you for joining us. Your engagement really enhances each episode, and I do welcome your thoughts and also the feedback on this one. Please also make sure you subscribe to the Strategy and Insider podcast for more conversations on the future of healthcare. So that said, stay tuned for our next episode and take care.
Strategy and Strategy made real.